This call is being recorded.
Tell the people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world's changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Wake up all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. Na 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, love, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. They don't have so very long before the judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it, girl, just you and me. Yeah. Change it, yeah, just you and me. Change it, yeah, change it. Do it alone, do it alone. Need some help, y'all, y'all. Do it alone, do it alone. Yeah. Wake up, everybody. Wake up, everybody. Need a little help, y'all. Yes, I do. Need a little help. Say it for some help, y'all.
Greetings to all of you, in the name of him who does all things well, even Jesus, who is the Christ. As president of the National Baptist Convention USA Incorporated, I thought it necessary to speak to us particularly at this particular time because America is in a phase of reopening. And because of that, there are many questions being asked. What about our churches? Even in our own state, our governor just recently relaxed many of the restrictions and basically advised churches to make that decision on their own and suggested that maybe June 1st would be a good time. I would like to suggest that from my perspective, I do not believe that our churches are ready to reopen. Not June 1st, and not even in the month of June. In fact, I say to you emphatically, New Hope Baptist Church on Beasley Road here in Jackson will not be reopening. You ask me why? There are several reasons. Number one, testing is still an issue in our country and in our community in particular. Number two, tracking or tracing still an issue in America and particularly in our communities. Number three, African Americans are infected at a higher rate in terms of percentages than anyone else in the country. Number four, African Americans die more often than any other group in the country. These issues are alarming issues. And for that reason, I do not believe that it is time for us to return to in-person public worship in our facilities. If you do not know where the virus is, you cannot tell who has it and who does not. In my opinion, the risks are simply too great for us to return at this particular time. Here's what I do believe. I do believe that this is a time for us to make plans to return so that when that time comes, we may simply implement our plans and return to in-person public worship and to do so in an environment that is as safe as it can be. My brothers and my sisters, I am sensitive, I really am, to all of the issues that are involved and that are related to this issue. I am sensitive to all of the economic issues. I am sensitive to all of our pastors and many who struggle. And for that reason, I will be very soon be asking those of us who are stronger, as it were, to be sure we make sure we help those who are not as strong, those who are indeed struggling, so that we can do so. I will be asking us very soon to help make that happen. But in the meantime, I want you to remember, we did not attend the Congress. We canceled the Congress. We did so for that reason. I am meeting via Zoom with the Executive Committee often as we contemplate the convention in September. What shall be our disposition? And we will inform you very soon as to what we believe God's will is for us as it relates to our convention. In the meantime, my brothers and my sisters, please know that because of all of the ancillary issues, the variables that we do not have answers to, at this particular time, I cannot, no way, recommend that you return. However, I am aware, I'm fully cognizant of Baptist Church polity, and I do adhere to Baptist polity, and I do know that churches will make that decision independently. But from my perspective, it is important that every preacher, every pastor recognizes how important it is for us to make sure that we seek to protect those persons that God has entrusted to our care. Now, there will be those who will suggest that perhaps it is a matter of faith or doubt that we do not return. I want to suggest to you once again, I do not, as president, see an inherent conflict between faith and reason. I do not believe it is a matter of reason or faith. I believe it is both, because I believe that faith is the completion of reason. And so we use reason and faith. And reason says to me, the time is not right. Too many unanswered questions. And so I cannot recommend that we return. In fact, I recommend that we pray and ponder before we make that decision to return. What about faith? Here is what faith says to me. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. That is what faith says to me. And finally, I want to encourage all of us to make sure that when we're in the public domain, we wear a mask. We practice social distancing. The experts, the scientists, and health professionals inform us that wearing masks, practicing social distancing, are the two greatest weapons we have to impede the progress of this invisible enemy. I encourage you to make sure you wear your mask and practice social distancing. And finally, my brothers and my sisters, someone will ask, are you optimistic or pessimistic? And I say to you, I am optimistic, because here's what I believe. If we retain faith in God, remain vigilant, we shall be victorious. And I encourage you not to see yourself as a victim, but as a vessel that God will use in a mighty way on the other side of this crisis. My brothers and sisters, be safe is my prayer. Practice social distancing. Practice wearing your mask in the public. And yes, know this, when God is for us, not even the virus can ultimately win that victory, because the virus is invisible. But our God is invincible. To God be the glory.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers. On Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
On evaluating Black privilege. Black privilege is the hung elephant swinging in the room, is the memory of a slave ship praying for the Alzheimer's to kick in. Black privilege is me having already memorized my nephew's eulogy, my brother's eulogy, my father's eulogy, my unconceived child's eulogy. Black privilege is me thinking my sister's name safe from that list. Black privilege is me pretending like I know Trayvon Martin on a first name basis. It's me using a dead boy's name to win a poetry slam. It's me carrying a mouthful of other people's skeletons to use at my own convenience. Black privilege is the concrete that holds my breath better than my lungs do. Black privilege is always having to be the strong one. It's having a crowbar for a spine. It's fighting even when you have no more blood to give, even when your bones carried you, even when your mother prayed for you, even after they prepared your body for the funeral. Black privilege is being so unique that not even God will look like you. Black privilege is still being the first person in line to meet him. Black privilege is having to have the same sense of humor as Jesus. Remember how he smiled on the cross? The same way Malcolm X laughed at his bullet, and there I go again, asserting my Black privilege, using a dead man's name without his permission. Black privilege is a myth, is a joke, is a punchline, is the time a teacher asked a little boy what he wanted to be when he grew up, and he said alive, is the way she laughed when she said there's no college for that, and it's tiring, you know, for everything about my skin to be a metaphor. For everything Black to be pun intended, to be death intended. Black privilege is the applause at the end of this poem. It's me giving you a dead boy's body and you giving me a 10. It's me being okay with that. And I tried writing a love poem the other day, but my fingers wouldn't move. My skin started to blister like it didn't trust me anymore. like you thought I was trading in this noose for a pearl necklace. Some days I'm afraid to look into the mirror for fear that a bullet George Zimmerman its way into my chest while I was asleep. The breath in my mouth is lucky enough to scare a courtroom. I'll be lucky if I'm alive to make it to the stand. For some people, their trials live longer than they do. Black privilege is knowing that if I die, at least Al Sharpton will come to my funeral. At least Al Sharpton will mason jar my mother's tears, remind us that the only thing we are worthy of is our death. We are judged by the number of people it takes to carry our caskets. Black privilege is me thinking that's enough. It's me thinking this poem is enough. Black privilege is this. Is this breath in my mouth right now? It's me standing right here with a crowd full of witnesses to my heartbeat.
Habari Ghani and Hotep, my brothers and sisters, good afternoon and welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am so happy that you are able to join us this afternoon. This is the Black Reality Think Tank weekend edition. We are here this evening to talk a little bit about things that impact our community and we as African people. So we're always appreciative. We are here every Saturday from 3 to 5 p.m. On the Time for an Awakening.com network, which is a part of the Black Talk Radio Network.com. We are also on Tuesday evenings from 7 to 9 Central Time. We are here at the same platform, Time for an Awakening and the Black Talk Radio Network. The Black Reality Think Tank Weekend Edition is sponsored by the Sankofa Historical Society. And the Tuesday edition is sponsored by Motherland Media. But we're always happy. Tonight, we're going to talk a little bit about the opening up of America from the COVID-19 situation. And we want to try to understand a little bit about how that might or may not impact us. And so we want to talk about some things and some things that we have researched and looking at. We thank you so much for that. We normally have with us two co-hosts, one of the co-hosts is graduating today from Alverno College and here in Wisconsin with her master's in psychology and education. So we definitely congratulate her and we wish her well. So with that, I want to do what we always normally do is our ancestral profile. We do that all of our programs because of the fact that we know that we come from greatness and we stand on the shoulders of greatness. And so today, since we are talking about medical things and things that involve us as relate to health, we're going to do an ancestral profile on Dr. Charles Richard Drew. Dr. Charles Richard Drew. Dr. Drew was born June 3rd, 1904, and he transitioned to the ancestral world on April the 1st, 1950. He was an American surgeon and medical researcher. He researched in the field of blood transfusion, developing improved techniques for blood storage, and he applied his expert knowledge to developing large-scale blood banks early in World War II. This allowed the medics to save thousands of lives of the Allied forces. As the most prominent African-American in the field, Dr. Drew protested against the practice of racial segregation in the donation of blood, as it lacked scientific foundation, and he resigned his position with the American Red Cross, which maintained that policy until 1950. So Dr. Drew, his alma mater was Amherst College, McGill University, and Columbia University in New York. And we want to just honor that dear brother because he was a giant in his field. Okay, we are going to move on. And we are going to talk a little bit about that. Brother Timothy, how are you doing this afternoon? I'm so glad you joined us. How are you?
I'm good, sir. I'm happy to be in the mix.
Thank you.
Wonderful program that you have on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Oh, thank you, my brother. And we always appreciate you. I really do. You are a very loyal supporter, and you never let us down. And we thank you so much for that. I want to talk just a little bit about this are opening up of America. We see what we said. We played an early PSA announcement a little while ago that dealt with a statement made by the president of the National Baptist Association of America. And very clearly, there's a mandate asking the churches, particularly of our communities, to start services again. And very clearly, Dr. Young issued a very bold and upfront statement and said that that was a bad idea. I appreciate that. And I think that, that the Black church has that responsibility to do that. A lot of us are asking the question, when is this COVID-19 going to end? And how will it end? What is it going to be there? And I know all of us are tired of being cooped up in the house and not being able to move about and having to walk around with masks on that we don't necessarily like. And it's sort of kind of like we are muffled. And that does create a lot of problems. And that's one of the reasons why on the Black Reality Think Tank, we have been doing a public service announcement, telling individuals how to make suggestions in terms of handling all of this. And I think a lot of our media has now turned to that. I was looking at the this morning's Wall Street Journal, and they have a whole section on what to do while you're at home, things that you can get involved in, how to make a new cup of coffee, how to plant plants, how to start a garden in your own home, creating music, and just all kinds of different things that people are suggesting, because this is very catastrophic for us as human beings. The human animal is not designed to live cooped up in this manner. And so I know it's having its toll on all of us. But however, we are facing this as a serious issue, a serious crisis. The COVID-19 disease, the germ, however, whatever you want to call it, is no joke. It's not something to play with. I, like so many of you, may have known several people who we have lost their lives to this this devastating thing. And there are others that are now sick and ill from this. And then the idea that we have been asked by people who are supposed to be responsible for the health of our community to return to normalcy, and they don't even have a way of testing, then they clearly don't have a cure. And yet we are asked to do that. And I understand that America is a capitalist nation. It's built on economics. Money runs this country in every way, every facet. And very clearly, the Black church is a part of that money machine. Education is a part of that money machine. Colleges have had to have their commencement via Zoom. They have had to have all kind of alternative methods. To do meetings and to go banking, to go to the grocery store. And I understand it takes its toll. But to introduce ourselves back out at this particular time is a real serious mistake. And so I think that we need to review that, and we need to determine just how safe and when, you know, we should take that advantage. So when it will end, I don't think anybody knows that. Nor do you know how it will end. There's a little piece I had read some time ago. It says that historians have looked at the whole idea of pandemics, and they have come up with the idea that there have been two types of endings. One is the medical ending, which occurs when the incidence and the death rates go down, and the social is the other one, when the epidemic of fear among the diseases sort of wings out. And those are the two ways. Well, a lot of this is fear. And I think that might be at the crux of urging us to go back out, is to kill some of that fear, to get money recirculated. States are running out of funds because they cannot pay the unemployment monies because folk cannot return to work. So if they open up the jobs again, then obviously that will take a heavy burden off of the state tax rolls and the federal tax rolls. So when people ask the question, when will this end? They are asking about the social ending, basically. one doctor says. He said it's really they're trying to figure out when is it going to end so we can get back to stuff, get back to my job, get back to working, get back to having fun, doing some of the things that we want to do during the summer and during the spring. But that's a scary one. So in other words, an end can occur not because the disease has been vanquished, but because people grow tired or panic mode and learn to live with the disease. Alan Brandt, which is a Harvard historian, said something similar was happening when COVID-19. As we have seen in the debate about opening the economy, many questions about the so-called end are determined not by medical and public health data, but by the socio-political processes. Endings are very, very, very messy, one historian said. Looking back, we have a weak narrative about ending. For whom does the epidemic end and who gets to say so? So in this path of fear, an epidemic of fear can occur even without an epidemic of illness. Dr. Susan Murray, who is at the Royal College of Surgeons in Dublin, Ireland, saw that firsthand, she said, in 2014, when she was a fellow at a rural hospital in Ireland. In the preceding months, more than 11,000 people in West Africa had died from Ebola, which was a terrifying viral disease that was highly infectious and often fatal. The epidemic seemed to be waning, and no cases had occurred in Ireland, but the public fear was palpable. On the street and on the words, people were anxious, Dr. Murray says, to get back to things. There was an article that was in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it said, having the wrong color skin is enough to earn you the side eye from your fellow passengers on the bus or the train. Cough once and you will find them shuffling away from you. The Dublin hospital workers were warned to prepare for the worst. They were terrified and worried that they lacked protective equipment. When a young man arrived in the emergency room from a country with Ebola patients, no one wanted to go near him. Nurses hid and doctors threatened to leave the hospital. Dr. Murray alone dared treat him. She wrote, but his cancer was so advanced that all she could offer was comfort care. A few days later, tests confirmed that the man did not have Ebola. He died an hour later. 3 days afterwards, the World Health Organization declared the Ebola epidemic over. Dr. Murray wrote, if we are not prepared to fight fear and ignorance as actively and as thoughtfully as we fight any other virus, it is possible that fear can do terrible harm to vulnerable people, even in places that never see a single case of infection during an outbreak. And a fear epidemic can have for worse consequences when complicated by issues of race, privilege, and language. And we see that every day in this COVID-19. There's a whole outplay of race, privilege, who's got money, who doesn't have money. Thing. We all remember the Black Death situation and its horrible things. The bubonic plague, as its real name, had struck several times in the past 2,000 years, killing millions of people and altering the course of history. Each epidemic amplified the fear that came within the next outbreak. The disease was caused by a strain of bacteria that was called Yersinia pestis, and that lives on fleas that live on rats. But the bubonic plague, which became known as the Black Death, also can be passed from infectious persons to infectious persons, to respiratory droplets. So it cannot be eradicated simply by killing the rats. Historians describe three great waves of plague, said Murray Fissel, a historian at Johns Hopkins. There's the plague of Justinian, which happened in the 6th century, that was the medieval epidemic in the 14th century, and then a pandemic that stuck in the late 19th and early 20th century. The medieval pandemic began in 1331 in China. This illness alone, with a civil war that was raging at the time, killed half the population of China. And from there, the plague moved along trade routes to Europe, North Africa, and the Middle East. In the years between 1347 and 1351, it killed at least a third of the European population. Half of the population of Siena, Italy, died from this disease. It is impossible for the human tongue to recount the awful truth, wrote the 14th century chronicle Angelo di Tura. He said, indeed, one who did not see such horribleness can be called blessed. The infected, he wrote, swell beneath armpits and in their groins, and they fall over while talking. The dead are buried in pits and in piles. In Florence, wrote Giovanni Vaccarelli, no more respect was accorded to dead people than would nowadays be accorded to dead goats. Some hid in their homes. Others refused to accept the treatment. Their way of coping, he said, was to drink heavily, enjoy life to the full, go around singing and merry-making, and gratify all of one's cravings when the opportunity emerged, and shrug the whole thing off as an enormous joke. Does that sound familiar, brothers and sisters? That pandemic ended, but the plague recurred. One of the worst outbreaks began in China in 1855, and it spread worldwide, killing more than 12 million people in India alone. Health authorities in Bombay burned whole neighborhoods trying to rid themselves of this plague. Nobody knew it made a difference, said the Yale historian Frank Snowden. Snowden said it is not clear what made the bubonic plague die down. Some scholars have argued that cold weather killed the disease, carrying fleas that would have interrupted the spread by the respiratory route. Dr. Snowden noted that in a lot of his writing. He said, or perhaps it was a change in the rats. By the 19th century, the plague was being carried not by black rats, but by brown rats, which are stranger and more vicious and more likely to live apart from humans. You certainly wouldn't want one for a pet, Dr. Snowden said. Another hypothesis is that the bacterium evolved to be less deadly, or maybe actions by humans, such as the burning of villages, helped quell the epidemic. The plague never really went away. In the United States, infections are endemic among prairie dogs in the Southwest and can be transmitted to people. Dr. Snowden said that one of his friends became infected after a stay at a hotel in New Mexico. The previous occupant of this room had a dog, which had fleas that carried the microbe. Such cases are rare and can now be successfully treated with antibiotics. But any report of a disease of the plague still stirs up fear among it. Among the diseases to have achieved the medical end is smallpox, but it is exceptional for several reasons. There is an effective vaccine which gives lifelong protection. The virus variola major has no animal host. No eliminating the disease in humans meant total elimination, and its symptoms are so unusual that infection is obvious, allowing for effective quarantines and contact tracing. But while it still raged, smallpox was horrific. Epidemic after epidemic swept the world for at least 3,000 years. Individuals affected with the virus developed a fever, then a rash that turned into pus. Field spots, which became encrusted and it fell off, leaving scars. The disease killed 3 out of 10 of its victims, often after immense suffering. 1633, an epidemic among Native Americans disrupted. all of the Native Americans that was involved into this epidemic and who got caught it basically died. Harvard historian Dr. David S. Jones, William Bradford, leader of the Plymouth Colony, wrote on account of the disease in Native Americans, saying the broken pusticles, which would effectively glue a patient's skin to the mat he laid on, only to be torn off. Bradley wrote, when they turned them, a whole side of his body or skin would peel off. It was the most fearful thing in the world to behold. The last person to contract smallpox naturally was Al Mayo Mayolin, which was a hospital cook in Somalia in 1977. He recovered only to die of malaria in 2013. The 1918 flu epidemic that we've been hearing so much about is held up today as the example of the ravages of pandemic and the value of quarantines and social distancing. Before it ended, the flu killed 50 million to 100 million people worldwide. It preyed on young to middle-aged adults, orphaning children, depriving families of breadwinners, killing troops in the midst of World War I. In the autumn of 1918, Victor Vaughn, a prominent doctor, was dispatched to Camp Devens near Boston to report on a flu shot on a flu that was raging there. He saw hundreds of stalwart young men in the uniforms of their country coming into the wards of the hospital in groups of 10 or more, he wrote. They are placed on cots until every bed is full, yet others still were crowding in. Their faces soon wear a bluish cast. A distressing cough brings up blood, stains, spit. In the morning, the dead bodies are stocked up in the morgue like cordwood. The virus, he wrote, demonstrated the inferiority of human inventions in the destruction of human life. After sweeping through the world, that flu faded away, evolving into a variant of the more benign flu that comes around every year. Maybe it was like a fire that, having blurred the available and easily accessible wood, burns down. Dr. Snowden said it ended socially. World War I was over. People were ready for a fresh start, a new era, and eager to put the nightmare of disease and war behind them. Until recently, the 1918 flu was actually largely forgotten. Other flu pandemics followed, none so bad, but all nonetheless sobering. In the Hong Kong flu of 1968, 1 million people died worldwide, including 100,000 in the United States, mostly people older than 65. That virus still circulates as a seasonal flu, and its initial path of destruction and the fear that went with it is rarely recalled. So then the question now becomes, in the midst of all of this history and all of this medical technology, how will COVID-19 end? Will that happen with COVID-19? One possibly historian says is that the current coronavirus pandemic could end socially before it ends medically. People may grow so tired of the restrictions that they declare the pandemic over. Even as the virus continues to smolder in the population and before a vaccine or effective treatment is found. I think there is a part of this social psychological issue of exhaustion and frustration, the Yale University historian Naomi Rogers said. We may be in a moment when people are just saying, that's enough. I deserve to be able to return to my regular life. It is happening already. In some states, governors have lifted the restrictions, allowing hair salons, nail salons, and gyms to reopen. In defiance of warning, now it's been warned by public officials that such steps are premature. As the economic catastrophic disease continuously wrecks by lockdown grows, more and more people may be ready to say, hey, there's enough. This is a sort of conflict now, Dr. Rogers said. Public health officials have a medical end in sight, but some members of the public see a social end. Who gets to claim the end? Dr. Rogers said, if you push back against the notion of its ending, what are you pushing back against? What are you claiming when you say, no, it is not ended? The challenge, Dr. Brandt said, is that there will be no sudden victory. Trying to define the end of the epidemic will be a long and difficult process. So we are looking at a very scary idea. I read this morning also that there seems to be some medication that has been found that might cure, but there's not enough of it to do anything. So they're going to begin testing it in some hospitals. I can imagine what those hospitals will be and who they will be, that it will obviously be situations of privilege and those who have the funds to do so. But I think nevertheless, we as African-Americans and African-American community need to be mindful of that as we think about our own selves and say, hey, that's enough. What are you saying when you say that? Enough to what? Just out of your boring? Maybe we may even get to the point where it's kind of almost like suicidal. I don't care. I'm going to die anyway. So, but I'm not going to go out like this. And so you take the risk and you begin to still move around and do the things you have to do. So I don't know. I think I want to open up some things for discussion. As you know, this is a call-in format for those of you who might be listening via the internet. By all means, you can call us and give us your thoughts. And our call-in number is area code 215-490-9832. Area code 215-490-9832. And so we'd love to hear from you, see what you have to think. So, Brother Timothy, let me go over here to you and see what you think. What are your thoughts? You think that we are at the social part of ending it, or is this a medical ending? How do you feel about it? What's the city of Philadelphia doing in reference to this?
Well, Dr. Rogers, the good thing about this didn't happen in 1801. It didn't happen in 1701 or 1601. It happened now. And we have to look at the origins of it. We have to look at Wuhan, China. I think that's pronounced Wuhan, China.
Wuhan, China.
And uh-huh. Exactly. And you know what, Dr. Rogers, there's so many things that they said that happened. They said that in the laboratories where this disease was somehow supposed to be destroyed and to stop the cultivation of it, it somehow got out of the lab. Now, see, that's interesting.
Right.
Because it takes me to the Tuskegee experiment. It takes me to the smallpox disease. It takes me to a disease in which is a virus called AIDS. And I think AIDS is a man-made disease.
Okay.
Now,
okay.
It comes out of that country, and somehow it's going around the world. Now, right there, Dr. Rogers, you have people who are now involved in it, like Dr. Fauci and the billionaire, is it Gates, Bill Gates,
okay.
Who are coming up with a virus. So all these things are connected. It's strange to me how a man-made disease, which is now destroying countries and populations, they have coming up with a virus, and they still don't know what they're dealing with, because if they did, they would go further into trying to destroy it. So was this a part of genocide? Let's look at this. This is different. This is different, doctor. Is this a part of genocide? Was this aimed for a population, somehow it got out? Or was
right.
it part of experimentation to take down a population in a country? So
right.
I looked this differently. This was not the end by play. And you and I weren't there during that time. We don't
right.
know how that got out.
We don't.
But we know that they can cultivate diseases in order to take down countries. And do I think that we're going to get rid of it? No, Dr. Rogers. I think it's going to reoccur. And do we know how to handle it? This goes to show you how Caucasians in this country are so used to their freedoms that they don't want to be tied down. They want to go back to work. They want their businesses open up. There are some blacks that are like that too, but we're at the bottom of all this. listen, when they have a cold, we have pneumonia. And their thing is that they have to get out. And guess what? When they don't get their way, they march on capitals around the country with rifles and guns, stuff that you and I couldn't do as black people to get their way. As a matter of fact, Trump came here a week ago telling the governor he needs to open up his state. The governor here, Wolf, is ignoring it, like the governor in New York is ignoring it. Certain governors are ignoring it. Certain Republicans are opening up. Dr. Rogers, we're not going to get out of this. But we have to have a certain type of moral connection with God and discipline. Mm-hmm. See, we've never been attacked in this country. We had a civil war in this country, but we never had no all-out war where we were depopulated. Like when Russia went to the war in World War II, they lost 2 million men.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We never had that here. And right now, I can see that the president, who has a diseased mind, who is talking about taking a pill and injecting Lysol and Clorox, does not know how to handle a crisis. Yeah. We're dealing with a person that has a disease, and we're dealing with a disease. No, we're not getting out of it because we have the wrong type of leadership.
Mm-hmm.
That's one thing. The other thing, I think that, was it a plandemic or was it a demic? Was it a plandemic, Dr. Rogers?
Mm-hmm.
And it got out of hand? I don't totally know.
Okay.
But I'll tell you something right now. We're not getting out.
Yeah, you're right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think we'll know that part. But it's, you know, I would have to say it is frightening because, you know, all of the things you raised are issues that don't have a solution. And that's the big part of it. Going out now and go back to work obviously is not going to resolve what the major premise is that we have a disease that everybody is catching. And that disease is killing people. So going to work or opening up your stores has nothing to do with impacting how that disease is going to work. Medicine hasn't been able to come up yet with a plan to counter the medical part of that, which means that we obviously can't control the social part of it.
Exactly.
So, you know, we're in the middle. So now the thing is, in terms of our communities and our people and our families, what do we tell them? Just to continue to stay inside, practice social distancing? But then that has an effect. It has a mental effect on people. It creates that. It's a death, but it is a slower death. You know, you don't die right away from that. But it begins, it's still a decaying process. You hear where I'm going with that? It's still.
I'm going to give you an example, Dr. Rogers. In 1998, I went to Puerto Rico to visit some friends I went to college with.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there for 5 weeks. And at night, they would spray Puerto Rico for mosquitoes. I said, this is great. I never saw anything like that. At night, when people are basically sleeping, and they like New York and Philadelphia, people up all night, they spray the streets for mosquitoes. I said to myself, they're not preparing like that in Philadelphia. They're not sterilizing this thing correctly because they don't know how to deal with it. At night, they should do the same thing.
Right.
And the buses and places of transportation, and well, nothing hardly is open in Philadelphia anyway. Seems to me they would tackle it better. And I think that's the same way to a lot of cities and states in America. Some, like California, my friends in California said, the governor there jumped on it first, and that's why they have less problems.
Mm-hmm.
Certain states handle it differently. Mm-hmm. You see?
Mm-hmm.
So Philadelphia is next to Jersey. Jersey and Philadelphia next to Delaware. And after that, you know, you go to D.C., you go to Maryland, and stuff like that. I think that we sleep at the wheel on how to handle it. Okay. And they don't really know how to handle it.
They don't.
As a result of that, like, for instance, how are we going to – I have a question for you, Dr. Rogers. How is the public school going back to school? Huh?
Who's the governor of Pennsylvania?
Wolf.
Okay.
He's a Democrat. And he's pretty good. And he works with the governor of New York, and he worked with the governor of Delaware, and that's good, the Democrat. But Dr. Rogers, when the school system goes back, how are we going to handle a first grade and a kindergarten? Tell them to stay away 6 feet from each other.
Right.
Or eighth grade, or high school, or college and university.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Rogers, and going back to people who have local businesses who might not go back to that business because now they don't want to pass the stimulus plan. I bet you the closer we get to the election, he's going to let the money go. And $1,200, Dr. Rise, that ain't no money.
Right.
That's what you need to pay a bill, maybe two. We're backed up, Dr. Rogers. They print their own money. What's wrong with them giving it out? They want to give it to the fat cats. Here we go with race again. We're more segregated than ever, Dr. Rogers. Look at what's going on in our community. And you people who have to get tested, and when they get, most of the testing sites in Philadelphia in white neighborhoods. Here we go again.
Now, what about places like Germantown? Have they been hit real bad?
Philadelphia has been hit real bad. You got to remember now, Dr. Rogers, Germantown is now black.
Oh,
and
okay.
That's being gentrified. See, all those places that are now once black are becoming white.
Right. I didn't know that.
That business that black people have, they're less schools. They tear down all our schools.
Right.
See what I'm saying, Dr. Rogers? And
right.
the black medical centers that we have, there are very few of them. We used to have a lot of them. We don't have Dr. Rogers, do you know we used to have black dentists and doctors? We had everything black. We don't have none of that. Dr. Rogers, we don't even fry chicken wings. Asian fry chicken wings in our neighborhood. Dominicans have stores in our neighborhood. We don't have nothing in our neighborhood. That's ours.
That's it. That's it. Yeah, that's really good.
So my question to you, Dr. Rogers, is, and guess what, Dr. Rogers, when we have black businesses in our neighborhood, black people hire black people. That's another problem right there. There's another problem. And Dr. Rogers, the money that we get, that the city gets, that the city got from the federal government, and the city got from the president, they got $96 million. I want to know, Dr. Rogers, when they're going to release the money. And I got another question, Dr. Rogers. Why do they keep raising taxes?
Okay.
In other words, they don't want even black people to have the houses that we have here to be here. They keep raising taxes, Dr. Rogers, and guess what? And we don't have any schools. So where's the money going?
Let me ask you, how would you
have... We got other problems, problems, Dr. Rogers, besides this disease.
Brother,
how
would you answer that question?
I think, Dr. Rogers, that city council does what they want to do with that money. And even though they have more black people than ever to vote on city councils, resolutions, those people who get there are being controlled and the money's going elsewhere. Now, so I tell people, I have these conversations all the time on your show, that when you have those offices, you have to have a certain amount of divinity when you get in there, a certain amount of consciousness for your own district and your constituents. You're not supposed to let somebody tell you to raise taxes in your community when if they raise taxes, you don't have nobody black, your color in your community.
Right.
See, we got other things in this disease, Dr. Rogers, going on. We know that crime is still going up, Dr. Rogers.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you something, Dr. Rogers, we got everything black here. We just got a black commissioner in here. Okay? She's worried about whether police officers that are females can wear different color fingernail polish. Are you serious?
He said, what did he say? What'd you say again?
She's worried about whether police officers who are females can wear different color fingernail polish. Are you serious? She just got here. And they say she's kind of afraid to step into territory. Why are you hiring her then?
Okay. Fingernail.
Come on, man.
That's funny. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure what's going on in a lot of cities. Some cities do better with public Raz Barak, who's mentored by his father. Who helped? His father helped Kenneth Gibson get in. So
well,
he mentored his son. It's just like you talked about Chukwuma Lumumba. His father mentored him. They do better in their cities because they have a sense of conviction, a moral conviction, consciousness, and divinity. That's what you do. You don't go in here spinning wheels, man.
Yeah.
You take what you have. Powell passed 67 pieces of legislation. I haven't seen a congressman yet do that. You see what I'm saying? Mayor Jackson with developers. Developers run Philadelphia, and developers are mostly white. You tell a developer, if he comes in here, how many contracts are going to have black people working on a contract? Let's be for real about this thing. You're going to let them just manipulate. You go in there with a plan. I want to know what your plan is. What are you going to do for black people? I have to ask you a question, Dr. Rogers. If Biden gets in, has anybody asked him what the black agenda is?
Well, we did that.
What are you going to do for black people?
We asked that question. You raised that question last week when we talked about Amos Wilson and looking at the whole idea. What is the agenda that we have set for our people?
Since there's been a new city council, Dr. Rogers, they don't start on time.
Yeah.
No, I'm very passionate about it because I've seen people successful do this stuff. And I see people who are not successful do this stuff. It's just like when Kwame Kilpatrick became the youngest mayor at 32, Florida A&M graduate, and then he got his law degree. Dr. Ross, that doesn't mean to me that you're the first this. But when you get in there, the opportunity to have a predominantly black city, and you didn't run it right.
Yeah, he abused it. Yep, you're right. He abused it.
Pete, don't come to me. I'm the first.
Listen, let me ask you.
You're not doing anything, huh?
Yeah, Timothy, let me ask you a question. You're a very strong community of activists, and you have been ever since I've known you. Let me finish. I'm asking you a question. I want you to answer the question. You can express yourself about it. Okay, you're very strong an activist. You come from one of the most progressive cities historically for African Americans in this country. So many things that we've talked about that have come out of Philadelphia. Other places didn't have, and other people didn't have. What do you think is the problem? For instance, just in your city, I mean, you can't speak for the whole nation, but your life in Philadelphia, why this decline has occurred so strongly in Philadelphia? Going back, I think to Wilson Good and some of the stuff he did. What would be your assessment of the decline of black life in Philadelphia?
I'm going to tell you exactly, Dr. Rogers, that me being 59 years old. Dr. Rogers, when I graduated from high school in 79, went straight to Lincoln University. This was a black predominantly city. They had its own businesses, cleaners, mom and pop stores, butcher shop, tailor shop, dress shop, jewelry shop, everything in those neighborhoods we had that we could go to our own movie theaters. We didn't have to go to Center City, Dr. Rogers. And when Wilson and our black suburban was Lavarock and West Oak Lane and Mount Airy, the blacks who stayed in South Philly, North Philly, and West Philly, their communities were vibrant, and they were well. But if you called yourself, you once lived in North Philly, you moved to Germantown and then to West Oak Lane. If you lived in South Philly, you moved to Southwest Philly, progressively. Yes, you did. But it was a black neighborhood. Dr. Rogers, we were doing well black. The black politicians did for their people. The dentist was in your neighborhood. The doctor's office was in your neighborhood. The teacher was in your neighborhood. Everything, whether it was underground money or whether it was above ground money, everything worked. Dr. Rogers, the first thing that hit us was dropping a bomb on the city of Philadelphia. They tied Wilson Good's hand up. He was the first black mayor we had. And they told him it was going to be a little device just to get them out of the house. Dr. Rogers, it was a C4. It was C4. Dr. Rogers, they dropped a bomb and it destroyed 61 houses and went up in flames. It killed women and children. That was the first bomb, Dr. Rogers.
Right.
Those people were killed. Let me finish telling you, Dr. Rogers.
I remember that.
Remember this, Dr. Rogers. Then after those people were killed, they rewarded them for nothing. Some of them just recently got out of jail, but let me get to my point. Dr. Rogers, that was the first bomb that was dropped on us. I came out of Lincoln approximately 1985. I think that bomb was dropped. The second bomb that was dropped on us, Dr. Rogers, was crack, cocaine. 1985 to 1995 to almost 2000, it tore the community. Philadelphia looked like crack dens. They were crack dens. And Dr. Rogers, when black people were selling drugs to each other in Philadelphia with cops looking at you, and letting you do it, but a part of it, it was okay when black people sell to each other in the black community. But guess what happened, Dr. Rogers? You had nothing but blight in the neighborhoods. And what happened? Another black mayor comes up there and tears down the houses and didn't have a second plan. And developers came in here and brought in white folks.
Mm.
That's the plan.
Which mayor was that?
The mayor who the bomb was dropped on was good. Okay. The second mayor who came in after Wilson Good, the second mayor after Wilson Good was John Street. John Street stood up to white people, but when he took down the lot, he didn't have a plan to the black man to come behind him and say, we're going to have development for black people. Developers did what they do. When they came in here, they got the lots cheap. They brought in white folks and they gentrified the community.
Okay.
The third thing that happened is Knox was a black man. And what we see, he was a Penn graduate who thought he was a white man. He'll never be a white man because white skin don't rub off. And now they raise taxes. Mm. And now you have, now you have a white man there who doesn't understand black issues. And now you got nine people on city council who could vote for a 10-year tax abatement to get rid of it so we could maintain our homes. He could vote on development with education and housing and schools. And city council who just got there seem like they're dragging their feet. Mm. I want to know what color you think you are and where do you come from? Where did you go to? Most of y'all went to the schools that's not there anymore. So I have a question with you, Dr. Rogers. So when Cecil B. Moore was around, you had black politicians and lawyers in your neighborhood. My question to you, my uncle said, you always complaining. He said, but Trim, it's your children that are there now.
Uh-huh.
And what happened to them? How did they lose their consciousness? How did y'all raise them? What made them lose their consciousness? My uncle always said to me, why did they skip from one point to the next? And most of us did our best to send y'all colleges and universities. And the businesses, half of y'all don't want to work in them and you didn't want them.
Mm-hmm.
What made them drop what they had? I'm pretty sure King said, if you want to sit next to white folks, he didn't say give your business up and want to go to theirs. What was the concept and how did this happen?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I'm going to take a break. And when I come back, I want to ask you about why you said that this possibly could be a man-made situation that we're dealing with COVID-19. I want you to just share your thoughts. I mean, I know you're not an expert at it, so you wouldn't be able to.
Guess what? I'm like you. I got common sense, and we watch and we read, don't we? And we listen, and we do it, and we're analytical. It takes a lot of that, don't it?
Yeah, it does.
Guess what? People like you, it's kind of hard for us to brainwash us because we're always thinking.
Right,
and we're not affected.
Well, let's take a break. Come right back, and I want you to explore that for just a second, okay?
No problem. All right, bye. Thank you.
Greetings to all of you, in the name of him who does all things well, even Jesus, who is the Christ. As president of the National Baptist Convention USA Incorporated, I thought it necessary to speak to us, particularly at this particular time, because America is in a phase of reopening. And because of that, there are many questions being asked. What about our churches? Even in our own state, our governor just recently relaxed many of the restrictions and basically advised churches to make that decision on their own and suggested that maybe June 1st would be a good time. I would like to suggest that from my perspective, I do not believe that our churches are ready to reopen. Not June 1st, and not even in the month of June. In fact, I say to you emphatically, New Hope Baptist Church on Beasley Road here in Jackson will not be reopening. You ask me why? There are several reasons. Number one, testing is still an issue in our country and in our community in particular. Number two, tracking or tracing still an issue in America and particularly in our communities. Number three, African Americans are infected at a higher rate in terms of percentages than anyone else in the country. Number four, African Americans die more often than any other group in the country. These issues are alarming issues. And for that reason, I do not believe that it is time for us to return to in-person public worship in our facilities. If you do not know where the virus is, you cannot tell who has it and who does not. In my opinion, the risks are simply too great for us to return at this particular time. Here's what I do believe. I do believe that this is the time for us to make plans to return, so that when that time comes, we may simply implement our plans and return to in-person public worship and do so in an environment that is as safe as it can be. My brothers and my sisters, I am sensitive, I really am, to all of the issues that are involved and that are related to this issue. I am sensitive to all of the economic issues. I am sensitive to all of our pastors and many who struggle. And for that reason, I will be very soon be asking those of us who are stronger, as it were, to be sure we make sure we help those who are not as strong, those who are indeed struggling, so that we can do so. I will be asking us very soon to help make that happen. But in the meantime, I want you to remember, we did not attend the Congress. We canceled the Congress. We did so for that reason. I am meeting via Zoom with the Executive Committee often as we contemplate the convention in September. What shall be our disposition? And we will inform you very soon as to what we believe God's will is for us as relates to our convention. In the meantime, my brothers and my sisters, please know that because of all of the ancillary issues, the variables that we do not have answers to, at this particular time, I cannot, no way, recommend that you return. However, I am aware, I'm fully cognizant of Baptist church polity, and I do adhere to Baptist polity, and I do know that churches will make that decision independently. But from my perspective, it is important that every preacher, every pastor recognizes how important it is for us to make sure that we seek to protect those persons that God has entrusted to our care. Now, there will be those who will suggest that perhaps it is a matter of faith or doubt that we do not return. I want to suggest to you once again, I do not, as president, see an inherent conflict between faith and reason. I do not believe it is a matter of reason or faith. I believe it is both, because I believe that faith is the completion of reason. And so we use reason and faith. And reason says to me, the time is not right. Too many unanswered questions. And so I cannot recommend that we return. In fact, I recommend that we pray and ponder before we make that decision to return. What about faith? Here is what faith says to me. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. That is what faith says to me. And finally, I want to encourage all of us to make sure that when we're in the public domain, we wear a mask. We practice social distancing. The experts, the scientists, and health professionals inform us that wearing masks, practicing social distancing, are the two greatest weapons we have to impede the progress of this invisible enemy. I encourage you to make sure you wear your mask and practice social distancing. And finally, my brothers and my sisters, someone will ask, are you optimistic or pessimistic? And I say to you, I am optimistic, because here's what I believe. If we retain faith in God, remain vigilant, we shall be victorious. And I encourage you not to see yourself as a victim, but as a vessel that God will use in a mighty way on the other side of this crisis. My brothers and sisters, be safe, is my prayer. Practice social distancing, practice wearing your mask in the public, and yes, know this, when God is for us, not even the virus can ultimately win that victory, because the virus is invisible, but our God is invincible. To God.
The following is a public service Shalom. Announcement from the Black Reality Think Tank.
My name is Leola Williams. I am the owner of an outpatient mental health and substance abuse facility. I am a clinical substance abuse and mental health counselor. I appreciate the Black Reality Think Tank for inviting me on their program to share with you some of the things to help reduce your fear and stress during this pandemic. I know we are all experiencing fear and uncertainty at this time, not knowing who or what to trust, coming from the media or the White House, which makes it difficult to remain calm. One thing that I would strongly suggest is to reduce the amount of time you spend watching the news. Try to increase your communication with family and friends. Listen to your favorite music. Perhaps start an in-home garden with your children. Have them to plant their favorite vegetable garden. Play a word game with family and friends, using the first letter of their name to create a word to describe themselves. Exercise together, make it challenging. Dance, show off your old routines. Share some of the rules from the old days that your grandparents implemented. Watch a movie together. Have a nice fun day together. Learn to breathe, relax, and take one day at a time and pray daily. These are just a few tips on how to reduce your stress.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All right, we're back, my brothers and sisters, and we have been discussing the COVID-19 mandate that we should open things back up and get back into the marketplace of life, regardless of what the disease has done or will do. The idea is to get back to normalcy, and we've been discussing what we feel is the pitfall to that sort of rationale. And I'm here with my good brother, Timothy, from Philadelphia. We've been kind of talking with that. There's some of you who are on the line that are listening. We appreciate you, too. This is the Black Reality Think Tank. We're here every weekend. This is our weekend edition. It starts on Saturdays from 3 to 5 p.m. And we're also on Tuesday from 7 to 9. All of this is Central Time. We're broadcasting currently out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And so we are able to be here with you. And we really thank you for, you know, supporting us and supporting what we're doing. The weekend edition is brought to you by the Sankofa Historical Society. And our Tuesday edition is brought to you by Motherland Media. So we, we thank you for this, your support. And we want to continue bringing you programming that we hope will be informative and empowering, as well as a listening tool. So with that, we want to go back to our conversation. One of the things that we have been talking about is the whole idea of this pandemic and what it really means. We've been talking about some of the history of diseases in this country. All of our programs, as you know, are broadcast, are archived, and you can always go to our archive at www.timeforanawakening.com and get copies of our program and listen to them 24/7. We are call-in format. Our number here is 215, area code 490-9832. 215-490-9832. Okay, so Brother Timothy, you said earlier in our conversation, you said that you were considered that this could have well been a man-made creation, just like you felt that the HIV virus was. Why do you say that? And what ideas maybe have provoked you into thinking that this could have been?
Dr. Rogers, I'm not a physician. I'm an educator like you.
Right.
But you and I have studied physicians. Charles Drew, Dr. Hildes, who did diseases, who came from Lincoln University and went to Howard University medical school. And we know all the things that people who are scientists are able to do. George Washington Carver, what he could do, 99 things with a peanut. And I know what scientists can do. You and I know that if they came across something with a disease, and you got to find a way to kill the disease before it gets out of hand with man-made animals, gets in food or whatever, the water, you got to control it. But once you get a hold of it and you can put it in a place where you can harness it, it's your job as a humanitarian. We're dealing with some unhumanitarian people to destroy it. Some people say, well, I could take this thing right here and I could use it for my own destruction. Or I could take this thing right here and I could kill it. Somehow, some way, how are you going to let something like that fester and you not take care of it? Somehow it comes out a laboratory in China, is in other countries. I'm thinking about that. What is the means of destruction that you're going to use? You know, Mussolini put poison gas in Ethiopia, right? When the Nazis and the Russians went into Poland and divided the country up. When they killed the Poles, Stalin was as bad as Hitler. They would dig a grave, shoot him, put it in them. The Russians and Nazis knew they had needed it for the front line in warfare. So they said, we got to save our bullets for war. So they came up with the concept of exterminating fluid, which is poison gas. So you and I know through war what people could do with a nuclear bomb, laser, flamethrowers, same animal using it all day, anytime. So what makes you think that they're not going to use it for a ways and means of mass destruction?
Okay.
I mean, that's just my position, Dr. Rogers.
I guess
I don't know totally, but I have an idea.
Yeah, I can understand your logic and where you come, you know, why you might feel the way you feel.
And I don't mean to cut you off, Dr. Rogers. I'm going to revisit this, that some people don't want a race to exist. Some people have in their mind, I want this Jewish race to no longer be around. I want this black race to no longer be around. I want to go to India and colonize this. And once I colonize them, I want them to be here. You have people that do that, and they do that to each other.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's for real.
I understand you. I understand it very clearly. I just wanted to let you and our listening audience know that we're going to cut our program just a wee bit short today. There's another engagement that we have here at 5 o'clock. And so we're going to stop at 4:30, which is 90 minutes. We usually hear two hours. So we've got about a few more minutes. So Brother Timothy, you have any closing thoughts on all of this, in terms of its ending and going back? Do you agree with with Dr. Young from the Baptist Association that we should refrain from being so quick to go out? Where do you stand on that?
I stand with that, Dr. Rogers, what he's saying. The ministers with the politicians and the community activists and the business people are involved with the tradesmen, the plumber, the electrician, the bricklayer, the construction workers, all as a whole have to stay strong in order to fight this madness that's above us. Run your own states and your cities and have more testing sites in order to preserve us for the next moment in time, the next month, the next week, the next year. Because Dr. Rogers, if we don't take care of this right here, next year this time, we'll be depopulated.
You're right about that.
I guarantee you, if we don't take care of this by this summer, next year around this time, we'll be depopulated.
Yeah. Already happening.
Yes.
Yeah. Already happening.
And Dr. Rogers, I would like us to revisit my time spending with the state rep in 186th District running for Congress and state rep, so I can give you a spin on the important offices that right. I learned that you should have and what you do, the Appropriations Committee, Speaker of the House, and Majority Whip. Those places you get into to bring appropriations to your community to help with business, schools, and medical centers, to go to the community, not to line your pocket or give it to other people. That's another conversation. I would like to get in that conversation with other people.
I surely agree with you 100%.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
It's always a pleasure, sir.
All right. That's great. Well, Brother Charrington, we're going to, like I said, close it on out. We've got, like I said, another engagement that we're clearly at 5 o'clock. So thank you so much for joining us. And we're going to come back. We'll be back on Tuesday. We're going to talk a little bit more about this political economic agenda that we're in. So be sure to stay tuned for us. I look forward to seeing you next week. Okay? Take care, my brother.
God willing.
Yes.
God bless.
God bless you. Thank you.